Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. And today we have, as a very special guest, our friend James Malaszewski, who is the author of the Grognardia blog, the excellent traveling volume zine. And he's going to be here today to talk about his 7-year and counting campaign in the Empire of the Petal Throne world. James, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Cool, cool. You, of course, are one of the most prolific writers in the old school scene, and your Grognardia blog is still putting most of us to shame, trying to keep our writing output up. And you're one of the world experts, I think, at this point on playing in the Empire of the Petal Throne. Maybe our viewers know what that is, but maybe if there's some new viewers today, maybe tell us a little bit about what that campaign world is.
Sure. So Empire of the Petal Throne is the second role-playing game that TSR Hobbies produced in 1975. The rules themselves are more or less original Dungeons & Dragons with some variations added to them, pre-Greyhawk original D&D, so there's no thieves, none of that, and the spell system's a little bit different, but the primary difference between Dungeons & Dragons original D&D is that it has its own unique setting, Tecmo, which is not based on European fantasy and history, but rather instead is an original creation of a professor from Minnesota, well, rather he taught at Minnesota, University of Minnesota, M.A.R. Barker. And the setting is a kind of a science fantasy setting. It's set on a planet, Tecmel, which is far away from Earth, tens of thousands of years in the future, where technology is so advanced that it's like magic. And then humans go to this world. There's a cataclysm that occurs that throws everything back to a more primitive state, and the people there, the human colonists there, along with the other alien beings that came with them, they sort of, they've forgotten what they once had. They don't understand the technology anymore, and it appears to them as magic. So that's sort of a rough outline of what the setting is actually like. So the campaign begins when you play the game at the many, many thousands of years after this collapse has happened, this fall. And so at that point, on the surface, it appears to be purely fantastical. But in reality, there's a sort of science fiction underlay to it. As we talked about this last time I was here, actually, a bit, about it's a secret science fiction setting. And that's roughly what makes Tecmel distinctive from, say, Dungeons & Dragons. I mean, D&D, as you know, and I'm sure you've talked about this many times, has lots of science fictional elements to it. But this one, the Tecmel, is very explicitly based on those kinds of golden age sort of science fiction, sort of very high-tech Clark's Law sort of science fiction. And that's one of the things that makes it very, very unique. Is there something else that you think people would be interested in knowing about?
I feel like that's a pretty good preview. If somebody didn't not know what EPT was, I think that's a pretty good overview. And it's interesting how we have had conversations with guests in the last year a number of times. I love this phrase "secret science fiction." Actually, is very useful. Tends to roll around in the undergrowth, down the basement of like a lot of campaign worlds and a lot of like D&D ideas. So it's kind of interesting to think about how early it was made really prominent in Tecmel. So it's really interesting to think back to that. So the main thing we want to talk about today is you've been running a specific campaign that you call House of Worms. And from what you told me, March, I guess, was the 7th anniversary of that. So
yes.
Some of us, so frankly, I'm really jealous, Okay. So I hear, you know, and we might, maybe there's going to be some super ultra, you know, old school guy that's going to come on and go, well, I've had my campaign running for 10 or 20 or 30 years or something like that. And I, you know, am very envious of those kinds of ongoing campaigns. I hear about it. I wish that I had managed to do that. I've never managed to do that. So how do you do that? How do you keep a campaign running for 7 years and going?
That's a lot of luck, to be honest. I mean, but there are many things I could talk about. The campaign began in March of 2015. This was back in the days when Google Plus was still a thing, if we can remember those days. And I had run two TechML campaigns prior to this, one back in the late 90s, one mid-2000s, first decade of the century. And I wanted to do it again. And I felt that I had a better understanding of the setting and better hooks for bringing in new players, people who were unfamiliar with the setting and the game and part of the So I just put out a call onto Google Plus, and I got a bunch of players. There were 7 players who initially expressed interest in playing. Of those, only 6 ever actually made it to the point where they played. One of the players, after he said he wanted in, he couldn't because of schedule. And of those 6, there was only 1 person with whom I had played extensively prior to that. Several of them were complete strangers to me. I never knew them at all, except, you know, online in a kind of a vague way. I'm sure you know what that's like. And that, you know, that was the beginning. That was the beginning of the campaign. I had no expectation at the time that it was going to last as long as it did. As a general rule, and maybe this is important, when I start something new, I do it with the expectation that it's going to go on for years. I don't plan things on the basis of, I don't do mini campaigns or, you know, extended arcs or one shots or things like that. I generally always assume this is it. I'll be playing this until I die. Now, it never really happens, but this is the closest I've come to that in a very long time. But that's the assumption. So that's the mindset I go in. So maybe that's part of it, right? I sort of think about that.
All right, can I interrupt and ask, are all 6 of those players still playing today?
4 of them are still playing. 4 of them are still playing. 2 of them dropped out around the same time due to just real life circumstances that prevented their continuing to play. But prior to their leaving, another person joined, and he's still with it. So 4 have been around for 7 years, 5 have been around for 6. Wow. And then there are currently 7 players in the campaign. The other 2 have been around for 2 or 3 years, I think. I'm sort of lose track. And then I've had other people who have popped in or out for short periods of time because they knew I was running it. And they said, hey, I've never played Empire of the Throne. I want to know more about TechML. Would you mind if I sat in? And that's usually pretty easily done. The campaign is set up in such a way that it's very easy for players to sort of join for short periods of time.
That's very cool. That's I know the one time I tried to run a long running campaign, I think I maybe made it to 2 or 3 years, but then continued to try and use the world that we had kind of organically grown from the output of that to like run more campaigns in. But what it's hard to call that still the same campaign. Like the only combining thread, the only returning player really is me. But I'm curious. So having had this experience, which I've not had. Are there any surviving characters? Is there any 7-year-old character in this game?
Yeah, there are. The 4 characters that survived in the beginning are still around. There's a couple reasons for that. One of them is I hope this doesn't destroy like my old school cred here, but I'm not a killer referee. Like I don't do that sort of thing for the most part. My players are also pretty smart for the most part. But honestly, I think the main issue is that the campaign is very social and exploratory, more so than combat oriented. There are extended sections where they spend a great deal of time involved in fighting and that sort of thing, but and I don't want to frighten people away because one of the knocks against TechML that is often said is that it's a It's a anthropology game. It's an exercise in fantasy anthropology. I've heard people use the term culture game. And there's something to that. There's something to that, certainly, because part of the enjoyment of it, and I think one of the reasons why it's lasted as long as it has, one of many, is that it's about these exploration of these fantastical cultures, and the players over time start to become acclimated to these imaginary cultures, and they start to think like the people in that setting. That was probably one of my proudest moments early on, when the characters, this happened probably about a year into the game, maybe a little longer, where through a magical mishap, they wound up transported to a far-off place. They didn't know where it was. And eventually they figured out where they were and how far away they were from home. And they began judging the other place, this other society and culture, through the lens of their home, their character, society and culture. Now, and Tecumel is a very, culturally chauvinist sort of place. It's an ancient world, and so the people there, they tend to think, well, the way we do things is the best. It's not a modern world. It's a traditional sort of setting. And so it's like, in this place, they do this thing. We can't, that's ridiculous. Like, why would you do that? That's strange. And they started, but the players themselves had become acclimated to the way things were done in the country, the Empire of Solyanu, which is the titular Empire of the Petal Throne. And they went off to this far off place where things were different there. And they started viewing, and that was a proud moment for me, just because it meant they got it, that they'd finally been acclimatized. They'd become acculturated to this imaginary place. And that was fun. It was really enjoyable. Now, sometimes it would lead to jokes and so forth, because the players knew what they were doing and they were aware of it. And I don't want to give the impression that we're super, super immersive in these things. I mean, no one's speaking, you know, constructive languages or anything like that. But it's fun to watch them engage with the setting through a character who himself has a different worldview.
That's really interesting, because I feel like, you know, as someone who really leans into the medieval fantastic war game end of it, some cranky old gamers can go, oh, you know, young people nowadays, they're gaming, they want to be, it's all social interaction, they're going to proms and all this kind of stuff. But it is interesting to reflect that angle of we're exploring really social situations was there right from the get-go, in the first couple months of D&D being published. So it's an interesting option that you can play old school, but you can still be not super combat oriented, actually.
Oh yes, absolutely. If people are familiar with like RuneQuest, the setting of Glorantha, it's like that. And that's a very old game. I mean, much like Tecumel, the setting of Glorantha predates role-playing games. And it was created to explore sort of ideas and alternate cultures and mythological approaches. And so Tecumel is a similar kind of thing. But it's funny, there are no proms in Tecumel, but there are a lot of weddings. there are weddings in Tecumel. And we've had a couple of occasions like that, because after 7 years, the characters are very strongly immersed in the culture. And I mean that in the sense that they have places within the world, right? Like, they're no longer just nobodies. They've risen to positions of prominence and authority within the fictional setting. And as a result, they've formed alliances of various sorts with NPCs and patrons and so forth. And that includes marital alliances. Like, the characters have married. We've had like two big weddings that happened in the game that were really excuses for, well, I shouldn't say that, but partially excuses for politicking and influence peddling and trading between different factions. And it's the kind of thing that if I were to have said that to myself that was going to be doing this, I would have thought it was the most ridiculous thing ever. It just seems absurd, right? It's sort of like playing house or something. But it's a very enjoyable thing, because it arises organically out of the play. It just is the thing that occurs through playing, and it's been absolutely wonderful. It's really enjoyable, and I think that's the other thing too that's kept the game going on, is that there are so many different avenues for the players to I was going to say cause trouble, but that's a somewhat negative way of putting it. But I mean, there's so many outlets for them to engage with the setting and do things and make them happen. And the campaign is very player driven, very character driven. It's quite open ended. I throw things at the players constantly, and sometimes they bite. And more often, they're like, "No, I'd rather do this other thing that I'm interested in." And if you can get that kind of engagement from the players, then you can keep the ball rolling for a long, long time.
That's great. That's great. I should give a shout out. So we currently have our image scroll growing, and those from what James told me earlier, those are player characters in the House of Worms campaign, and those pieces are all done by Zhu Beiji is the artist's name. And if anybody's interested in seeing more, you can go to his website at realmofzhu.blogspot.com and see more of that. So big thanks to Zhu for sharing those portraits.
That particular picture isn't a Tecumel one, though.
Oh, okay. My bad.
That's from another thing that I'm working on, but it's still a lovely picture, so I'm not going to...
Great. Now, I will say, you know, it's funny you say that there's weddings in Tecumel because coincidentally, Paul and myself were at a wedding last weekend, and things happened. You agree with that, Paul?
Yeah, sure. For sure. Of course things happened.
That's interesting to reflect on.
Yeah.
So that's a good opportunity for possibly high drama. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, very very much so. And that's the way things go generally in the campaign, is that almost everything is an opportunity for scheming and interaction, and just sort of finding little things that the players are interested in. And like, I got to repeat myself, but I will. That's one of the big things that has happened, is that the players have found things that interest them. And I always run with that. It's better to do that than to try to force upon them things that I'm interested in, because who am I?
I just want to draw attention there. So there's a little bit of chat going on right now amongst the viewers about experience points and levels. And our viewer and your player, James Stephen Wendell, is in there answering some questions. So thank you so much for doing that, Stephen.
I'm going to throw up Bill's question that started this, which is great. Right. So Bill Rubin, who always asks great questions, asked, how do you manage experience points? And yeah, thanks to our patron Steven and your player for answering some part of that. But I kind of want to hear it from the horse's mouth. How, particularly if it's low combat in original D&D, is that a problem with the experience not accruing fast? Or
where I wanted to go with that question. Yes.
Great minds.
So Empire of the Pale Throne being a D&D derivative game, the way it works is that experience points comes from a combination of combat and from the recovering of treasure. It's exactly the same as D&D. Its main difference, though, is that it's actually harder to advance in original Empire of the Pale Throne than in original D&D, because there's this mechanism where as you go up in level, the amount of experience you get is, like, after third level, the experience you get is halved. And then after, is it sixth level, I think it starts, then it's quartered. And then after that, you get 10% of the experience. So, yes. So, as a result, in this campaign, after 7 years of play, there's only one character who is seventh level. And that's the highest character level in the game. And he only got to be seventh level because there was a magical book that gave him experience to gain one more level. He should be sixth. So in terms of XP that's been accumulated, it's only been sixth is the highest. And that's a character who's existed since the beginning of the campaign. Wow. So I only award XP from those things, which means that as a result, the advancement is slow, relatively speaking. But what I have found is that absolutely no one cares, precisely because most of the action of the campaign, a lot of the action of the campaign is social. It means that it doesn't, like, what your combat abilities are isn't really significant much of the time. The other thing it's done inadvertently is that it's preserved that sweet spot of D&D where the mechanics work really well, where you're not so weak that you can be killed by something insignificant, but you're also not so powerful that you can never be put into any kind of danger, or that your abilities are such that they could be literally world shattering.
Interesting. I'm going to throw up an addendum that that Steven just put up in the chat that I think is interesting. Steven Wendell is saying, and that character got that book as a wedding gift.
It's true. It is absolutely true. The character, in fact, I think I sent you, there are two pictures that I sent you, images that show a man and a woman, and they both represent two different married couples from the campaign. So one of them, the one that Steven has referenced, his character is from a, yes, that's the very one right there. Nabusa is his name. And he comes from a very high clan. He's not a member of the House of Worms clan. He's rather the cousin of the wife of another character who joined the campaign about a year into our playing. He comes from a very high and impressive and important clan. So when he was married in the Imperial capital, one of his wedding guests was one of the potential heirs to the Puddle Throne. And he was given this as a gift. So it was a big deal. I mean, as it turns out, it was all part of a plot by said Imperial Prince to influence him to do something that he wanted. It didn't work. But that was the intention. So it's like a nice bit of bait in order to try to push the characters in a certain direction. But as I say, it's up to what the players want to do. And sometimes they don't bite.
So can I ask, like, how often are you handing out XP? Are there long stretches of time where there's simply none? I mean, I'm assuming with not a lot of combat that really it boils down to treasure. And my experience with D&D is that that's very spiky, right? You have lots of sessions where there's no treasure, then suddenly we found a hoard and everybody's very excited and leveling perhaps happens. Is that what you're finding, James?
Yeah.
Oh, we've lost your audio, James.
The spikiness is exact. I'm sorry, I had muted myself because I didn't want. The spikiness is exactly correct. That's exactly the way it goes. There will be long stretches of time where they will gain no experience points. Mostly they will gain them when they're poking around in ruins and underworlds and things of that sort, which happens quite regularly. So to sort of backtrack just slightly, even though there's a great deal of social interaction, and that's a huge part of the campaign, there is also the search for, as Steven's character always says, cash and prizes. That is his motivating factor. He's probably the character who's most interested in that. Since the very beginning, he's an adventurer at heart. He wants to go out there and explore the ruins, fight the monsters, get the stuff. And so as a result, there are these times when they're spending a great deal of effort to delve around in ruins and extract things. In fact, that's what's happening in the campaign right now. They're in the process of doing that. So that's when they tend to gain the XP. But there'll be weeks or even months where there's no experience points. Heck, there's weeks or months where they don't roll any dice. So,
wow.
Now, okay, so that kind of dovetails into my next question. And again, possibly for old school players, the answer is going to be obvious. But I feel like if fifth edition players are watching this, they might expect, if it's a heavily social interaction campaign, they might expect a lot of social skills. Do you have specific mechanics or roles or abilities or skills to handle the social interactions or not?
It's interesting you ask that because Empire of the Pale Throne does have a very rudimentary skill system compared to original D&D. So it has skills that basically represent areas of competence, just things that you know. But there's no real, for the most part, there's no real rules for how you use them. It's sort of, so if your character is, say, for example, an animal trainer or a hunter or something of that sort, it means that it's a way to just say, okay, your character likely knows the kind of things necessary to do those things. There's a thing in the game called an adventure roll, which is a percentile roll that you make that's based on a combination of ability scores. Just sort of, when in doubt, and you don't know, you just make a roll and you see whether you succeed or not. And I do make use of those. But almost none of those skills are socially oriented. They're mostly just areas of knowledge and competence for the most part. There are a couple of skills that sort of touch on that a bit, but most of what happens in the game is done through the players themselves, you know, coming up with what they want to do. Some of the players are just really good at being able to navigate social environments. Others are actually good at it, but their characters aren't, and so they intend not. They are not the typical spokesman in these kinds of environments. When they're meeting an imperial prince, they keep their mouth shut. They don't want to offend. Whereas others are much more, you know, comfortable with that sort of thing. But there's no actual, for the most part, there are no skill roles. It's all entirely done through talking.
Fantastic. So there's no safety. It's role playing with no safety net.
I suppose that's a way of putting it. I mean, the thing is, and again, I want to stress this. It's much like the business with constructed languages. Tecumel's famous for having these languages. I am not the kind of referee who says that, you know, if your character is in a position where he would know something, the right way to approach something. If the player doesn't, I'm not going to say, well, it's too bad for you. It's sort of like, I regularly will say, okay, your character, given his status and position, would be familiar with this and know these kinds of things, and to sort of give that to the player to use as a basis of making their own decisions. I wouldn't penalize someone because they're not themselves as knowledgeable about the setting as I am. But again, players over 7 years have become quite knowledgeable about things, and they increasingly make their plans on the basis of what they know about the setting and the way things work.
That's great. You know, so you briefly touched there for a second on the famous languages in Tecumel, and it occurs to me when you were saying, players are good at social interactions, but they play their characters in a different direction, which is great. One thing that I found in my most recent original D&D campaign was leaning really hard into the languages issue of every different creature type. Every different intelligent creature type has its own language, and the player characters have a fairly limited number of slots. Is that in different circumstances, different players had to get pushed to the fore because they're the only person that knows language whatever. So even if someone wasn't normally the spokesperson, if one person knows the language of bugbears and they run into some bugbears, all of a sudden that player is actually forced to take the spotlight for a little bit, and they have to be the spokesperson because nobody else can do it. How much does that, do the players in your group generally just like all know the same languages? Does that kind of interaction happen a lot for you?
Yes, it actually does. It's funny. Languages are a big part of the game. The creator of Tecumel was by a professional linguist, so naturally languages are very important. And he spent a lot of his early life in Southeast Asia and learned to speak various languages. And so it was a significant thing to him. So in the campaign, many of the characters begin play with certain languages, like in D&D. And others don't. And so as a result, when they go places, the characters who can speak the languages, just as you described, become more important. The difference is that over the course of time, they have learned languages. Like they have they've hired people to teach them. You know, they'll get tutors to instruct them in them, or they'll hire local interpreters or guides or things of that sort to do that. But the overall point that you're making about how certain characters will come to the fore because of their unique skills is very much the case. And that's one of the things that's fascinating over the course of 7 years, is that, you know, characters start to have a niche where, you know, this is a job for, you know, Znayashu, this is a job for Kelino or whoever. These various characters who have areas of interest and specialty and competence, and they will become, you know, more important as a result of that, which is an enjoyable thing to watch, again, as a referee, because you never, it's not focused on a single character, right? Like, it really is an ensemble. And the other thing, too, that I should add that's contributed to this is that many of the players, actually almost all of them, have at least one, if not a couple of other characters whom they play from time to time. Precisely because it's been going on for so long, they've acquired entourages of, you know, they have protégés or hangers-on of various sorts that are with them. And, you know, if one character is interested, well, to give an example, I mean, relatively early on when the characters went to a new area, one of the characters was interested in doing exploration. He was wanting to go off and into the wilds and see what was going on. It didn't make sense for certain of the characters to do that with him. They weren't interested, and they didn't go. So what happened is the player characters who made sense for it to go, they left. The others, the players, they picked up new characters. They had other people whom they would play. And so we split the group, the campaign. Like, there was one group that was doing one thing, and then when they were busy with something, we would go back to the other group and play that. And so as a result, now there are a lot of characters floating around. And you have people that you can rely upon. Some of them are lower, almost all of them are lower level characters. And they're different, right? They're different characters from who they normally play. And that's why even if someone were to die, a character were to die, it's not a problem. You can just pick up someone and keep playing because they're already established. And so you were saying, Paul, earlier about how it, even though it's the same world, it didn't feel like it was the same campaign anymore because there was no character continuity. But in this case, we've already established these other characters. So even if they're minor, you know, they're not in the main credit sequence, if you will, if it were a television program, they're still recurring guest stars, and then they get elevated to main cast if somebody should die, and that's the way it goes.
I mean, that's something I certainly experienced in my own campaign, but more so, I think, possibly because it sounds like maybe my campaign was a little deadlier, so we saw just turnover of characters dying, and so players creating new characters, not that they had other ones in the wings, which is fascinating. I actually love that idea. But I always delighted in that. I delight in those moments when the players, you know, are forced into a situation. I guess the example I have is there was a case where I had some of the same players I had had before, but they were all playing new characters, and they were looking for a map to a location, and they talked to an NPC, and they paid a fee, and they said, yes, we know that some explorers once explored there, and they made these maps, and I literally handed back to the guy, the player, the maps that player had created. As a different character. So, yep, here you go. And he just absolutely rolled his eyes at me of like, oh no, I know that these maps are awful.
That's an absolutely terrific story. I like the way, no, but I mean, truly, I think that's terrific the way that there's that continuity through like an artifact, an object in the campaign. Yeah. And I think that's terrific. And I was going to say, for what it's worth, I ran about a year after I started this game, I started a second Empire of the Book with a different group of players. That one only lasted for 2 years, precisely for the reason it was very combat heavy. And by the end of the game, only one of the original characters was still around. And everyone else had replaced their characters multiple times, so there was barely a thread of continuity anymore. And it just didn't feel like the same campaign anymore. It felt very different. And so that sort of spoiled some of the fun. So I don't know. I don't have a strong opinion on the matter, but I do think it's important if there be that thread of continuity, which is why I am really grateful at this point that there are those additional characters, because the things that the characters are doing now are pretty dangerous. And I won't say I live in fear because I don't, but I mean, I do wonder, I think, okay, this is it. They're going to kill themselves. And they've come so close so many times. I mean, one of the player characters has actually died twice. And it was incorporated into the sort of evolving mystery of what they were investigating. And I was very happy with the way that worked, but it was purely, it was not intended. It was not intended that that was the case. The player, that was Steven's character, had done something that was foolish. He cast magic while wearing armor, metal armor, which you shouldn't do because it has a... And he killed himself. And then the players, rather than leave him, they said, okay, we got to find a way to bring him back dead. And they did. But it was in this foreign city-state in this unknown land, and they got him brought back. But when he came back, there was something off. It wasn't quite right, because he had seemingly infused with the power of a foreign deity. And so he started behaving a little differently, and he had certain knowledge and abilities that he didn't previously have. And that was very useful to me in presenting things about this other culture. And they got to learn more about it because these people treated him like, oh, well, he's the vessel of a god now. So this is perfect. We've been waiting for this moment. You're going to lead us into war against our enemies, right? And it never happened. But the point is, that's what was being pushed. Again, as I say, I keep pushing these things, and the players, they just don't listen. They have their own ideas.
So Stephen is currently in the chat defending his choice, and I'm gonna respect and let him continue to defend his choice on that. But this brings up a really interesting issue about how much resurrection magic is available and how much it affects a long-running campaign. And so one of our top patrons, Joshua, has made the point multiple times that, you know, we think of old school D&D as being super brutal and having a high body count. But on the other hand, you know, resurrection raised dead spells have always been in the core rule book from day one. And maybe it was intended that that was fairly easy to access. I personally am someone that is kind of slightly aggravated about the world building aspect, about having resurrection magic apparently like a commonly functioning part of the world. But Joshua makes a pretty darn good argument that maybe that is what part of the game is intended to be, and that does keep continuity of characters on. So in EPT, how it, or at least the way that you run it, how easily accessible is resurrection magic, and how does that affect the campaign world?
Yeah, that's actually a really good point. And I largely agree with the idea that original D&D had, you know, raised dead in it, or in reincarnation. So, I mean, these were things that were intended to be used. They weren't put there, oh, you know, you shouldn't use them. But as for the campaign, like you, Dan, I worry about the world-building implications, like, a great deal. And Tecumel, more so than a lot of settings, is very tight in the way that it presents its setting. And so I do worry about that. But like D&D, original D&D, Empire of the Pale Throne includes rules for raising the dead. Like, there are spells and magics of various sorts that will allow you to do that. So I was of the opinion, okay, you have to be able to allow that. But what I have done in any occasion where it's occurred is I've made sure that I try to contextualize it in the setting. So I tend to restrict it there. In the Empire of the Pale Throne, Sol'Yanu, there are 20 gods that are worshipped, and they all have their particular spheres. And there are two gods of death, one of whom is Sarku, who is the god that the House of Worms worships, and he's all about the undead. Actually, is about the preservation of the intellect after death. Because at Sol'Yanu, they believe that there's a kind of a reincarnation that happens. The sort of animating principle when you die gets recycled into another person. But your ego, your you, your memory, everything that makes you distinct, that just dissolves away. But the worshippers of the god Sarku, this one god of death, they're interested in preserving that forever. But the only way you do that is by becoming undead. So that's one thing. But then there's another god, Belkanu, who is also a god of death and has a different perspective on things, and the undead are not part of his perspective, his point of view. All this is a long way to say that I do allow these things, but it's always done in a... I pay attention to the society and, you know, who would be interested in bringing people back from the dead? What would they want from allowing this magic to be used? And what are the consequences of that? So it's not just, you know, go on down to the local cleric, he raises you up, you give him his gold, and that's it. There's always something attached to it. So that's what happened when Steven's character, Ifo, died the first time. Was expected, he was brought back, but there was an expectation from these people, the Noxai, who were a foreign culture, that he was going to fulfill some important tasks for them, including leading them in battle against their enemies. And so for a long time, the characters were entangled in the politics of the city-state where these particular people were from, and it led to lots of very, very interesting things for months. I mean, it sort of was an engine for the campaign, and I was very happy with the way it turned out. And it was totally unintentional. It was not something that I expected to happen. I was, in fact, quite shocked at the time that the character had died, because it had been so long since I'd even really given much thought to that. Oh, no, what are we going to do? And so there it was. And it worked out really well, and I'm very pleased with the way that turned out. It's another one of many, many moments that are quite memorable over the course of 7 years.
If I could editorialize just for a second, I like the fact that, you know, old school D&D of the DM having the authority to twist spells in ways that aren't actually written in the book, particularly for the top level spells, right? So Raise Dead, Reincarnation, they're at the top level for original D&D, along with like Death Spell and Control Weather and, Summon Stalker? What am I thinking of? Invisible Stalker spell, stuff like that, where you're summoning an extra dimensional entity. And I personally really like the DMs keeping somewhat of mystery behind those top level spells and having the authority to twist them for their campaign in ways that keep magic mysterious and subtly unexpected and dangerous. And so I love hearing what a great effect that had on your campaign, James, to be able to do that.
Yeah, really, I mean, the thing is, as I was saying earlier about Techmel being a sort of secret science fiction setting, the magic isn't as poorly understood by most people in the setting, and it's sort of held by these temples who have this knowledge that they've marshaled for untold centuries. And so, as a consequence, you know, even people who are fairly intelligent and well read and educated don't know all these details. So the setting itself helps that a great deal. It's very, very easy to do that, and it just feels appropriate. It feels like something that should be in the setting, that kind of mystery and secrecy about the way those most powerful magics work. So, in some settings, I guess it would be harder, perhaps, to do that. It depends on how you present things. But I've tried very hard from the beginning to sort of emphasize that. And that's in Techmel, that is the kind of setting it is. It's filled with mysteries and secrets. And I think that's what keeps things going, too, because the characters are always on the lookout to try to find a new thing that they didn't know before. And every time they peel back another layer of the onion, there's more underneath it. And it just sort of keeps it going for a long time.
That's great. That's great. So I've got my eye on the time here, and I have so many things I want to ask James, and now I know I'm not going to get them in all at once. You have a player in your game that's pretty well known as a map maker. Can I say his name on the show?
I don't think he would mind. No.
Okay. So James sent me a city map that one of his players, who's Dyson Logos, made, and we have it on screen currently. And we can't show it on screen in its full glory because it's the single biggest map I've ever had to deal with. It's 13,000 by 20,000 pixels. And so the detail that Dyson put this into this map is unreal. And there's a zoom in, like the next slide. Okay, so this still isn't fully zoomed in, right? This is still zoomed out by like about a half. So the amount of detail that Dyson put into this map, where the House of Worms clan house and everything else is located, is just jaw-dropping. This hasn't been published anywhere. Is that right, James?
That particular version, I think you can get, it's on Dyson's website. Okay. So if you go to his blog, it's there, and you can find it. An earlier version of that appeared in an issue of my Techmel zine, The Excellent Traveling Volume. That is the city of Linyaro, which is a colony of Solyanu that's in a far off place. Most of the campaign over the last 5+ years has been taking place in this region that's far from the main campaign setting, where the characters, you know, the Empire set up this outpost. used. And there's the city of Lin-Yarrow, which there was no map of it because it just a little point on a map. And we just decided, okay, well, what does it look like? And we are very, very fortunate. I am very, very fortunate in that I have a master cartographer as one of my players. Bison's been playing since the beginning, and I knew of him, but I never knew him well prior to this. And so he's always sketching out maps. And so we just started talking about, what does this place look like? And he started putting it down, and people started adding details. And bit by bit, it grew, and it turned into this thing. And then a big event happened in the game where there were these demons that were summoned that burned large portions of the city down. So the characters who are part of the colonial administration, Steven's character, Itho, is the governor of the colony. They just say, well, here's an opportunity to make the city look the way we want it to look. And so they move things around. They put up new structures. Again, they get engaged in politics with various clans and temples and power groups and factions, and decided, well, who wants to be close to the governor's palace? Who wants to get shunted into the new suburbs that we're building and all of these things? And it was great. And so that version that you're showing there is, I think, the most recent version, because there's two parts, I don't know if you can see, in the sort of the north top of it, that are kind of sparse, that are not very open. And those are new areas that have been built over the course of the several years that the characters have been running this colony. And so, you know, they added extra walls. And so that's what they've been doing. Like, this is the domain game, if you will, except it is a single city that they've been put in charge of, that's part of this far off colony. And it is amazing to me how much time we've spent in sessions. Again, this is to give you a good example of what I mean by when I say social, where they're doing this. They're negotiating with different factions and seeing what they can extract from them, what sort of favors they can get in order to put them in one place or another. I mean, you know, we joked, it said, who else has a campaign where you spend, you know, several sessions engaged in urban planning? But they did, and it was fun, and it was very, very enjoyable, right? It's the same way, you know, another character, like, we spent an entire session about matchmaking. He was looking for a wife, and so he was going around to different clans and seeing who had the best, who could offer the best to him. And it was disturbingly fun. It was really, really enjoyable.
I'm curious, that's James, awesome. This will segue into the question that John Miller has asked recently. Dan, if you want to put that on screen. Definitely. I'm just kind of curious, like, how much of the content of your campaign has come up organically, or stuff that you're inventing on the fly, versus what you planned ahead, versus what is actual written material that you started with. Maybe we can unwind that and start from the beginning and ask John Miller's question, which is, what's the best way to get started as a DM when setting up a Techmel campaign? What books or games do you recommend?
Okay, well, that's a very easy question. If you're just starting with Techmel, Empire of the Petal Throne is all you need. You just start with that. It's very basic and simple. The amount of setting material there is very small by comparison to other stuff. I think it's a lot less off-putting compared to the later material, which in Charity, I would say, is written in a kind of a dry academic style. It's very off-putting, I think, to people. And honestly, I don't use all of it. It's just, it's impossible to use all of it. I forget details all the time. You know, you have a book that's a couple hundred pages long, just filled in tiny, you know, 8-point type. It's like, I would recommend Empire of the Petal Throne would be the place to start. And then if you like that and are interested in more, there's another book called the Techmel Sourcebook. And that probably tells you more than you would ever want to know. But it's the kind of thing, I would say, you read it, you get a bit of the flavor, and add little details as you will, right? Like, don't worry about knowing every single detail, because no one's going to care. It's all about the overall sort of, as a flavor of the thing. Make sure that it doesn't feel like your typical vanilla fantasy thing. But that having been said, and this goes to the other question you were asking, there are still a lot of empty spaces in tech. Like, certain things we know a great deal about, other things we don't know almost anything about at all. For example, this city, Lin-Yarrow, this colony, is in a place called the Southern Continent. It has no other name because it's just far away and people don't know what's there. And so in the course of the campaign, the better part of the campaign I've been running, all the details are largely made up by myself, because it's a blank section of the map. Like there's nothing there. We know that there's this culture called the Noxai. They're different than everyone else. They worship different gods. They have different customs, but what those are, we don't know. So I made them up, and that's being done. That's a constant evolution over the course of play. And that's the part that's really been enjoyable. I mean, that I like coming up with new things in a larger context that already has been laid down. But ultimately, it's still, you know, my ideas. So that's new. And if someone else were going to be playing and doing a similar thing, I would recommend you do the exact same thing. You make up those details as you need them, and don't worry about it's. I think what happens is because Tecumel is so well, what we have is so well presented, people think that they're going to break it or ruin it or somehow they're not capable of doing it themselves. But honestly, it's not like that at all. It's no different than any other well-established setting. There are plenty of gaps for you to add your own individual creativity. And you just and if you don't like some detail, change it. Like, I don't see any reason why you shouldn't do that. It is your game, after all. And every version of Tecumel that's ever existed, in the introduction, it says that thing. It says, you know, I'm presenting my version of Tecumel, now create yours.
That's great. I feel, you know, it's funny when you say that, James, because I feel that the places where, you know, D&D adventures or campaigns have left gaps, or I might say lacuna, are the things that my mind goes to. Like, I mean, my mind is like, that's a problem I got to solve. But it's specifically the thing that keeps me coming back to, like, find out more about it. And myself, like, for someone who's got a little bit of a mathematical bent, I actually have to fight with my instinct to completely formalize the thing and close it off and remember to keep leaving these, oh, and maybe there's something over there and there's a tunnel down here and I don't know where it goes right now and there's a lost level, to keep the interest ongoing, particularly if you want to have like an open-ended ongoing campaign. Do you agree with that? I mean, do you try to like leave things that you still don't know in the parts that you make yourself?
Absolutely. Yes, definitely. I've said sometimes, and it is not an original thought to me, and I think it's true of a lot of people who create, in the course of playing and going through all of this, I'm learning about the setting as much as the players are, right? It's an opportunity for me to, you know, their characters are literally exploring the setting, but by their going off into those little blank spaces on the map, it's an opportunity for me to figure out what's there, because we don't know. So I had to come up with some answers for that. And it's been enjoyable. I mean, that's one of the things I find really great about this. And I think, you know, if I were to try to sum up, I guess, you know, how the campaign has survived for as long as it have and continue to maintain interest, it's the fact that there are so many things left unexplored, unanswered. There's still lots of mysteries and secrets and places to go, people to meet, you know, things to discover. And, you know, I made this onion reference earlier, you know, about peeling back the layers. And it's just every time the characters do something and they think they've got a handle on it, they find out there's more that they don't actually know. And they may not be prepared at that time to deal with it, but they'll remember it and they come back to it, or they don't. And then it just becomes another one of those dangling threads, but they still could come back. I mean, I've been amazed how often something that was presented years in the past will suddenly come up again. And they're like, hey, yeah, you remember that time when we did this or we met that person? I bet you that's related to this. And it's like, actually, that's exactly right. Or, well, it is now, right? Because that's another thing too, right? I like to say I'm kind of a lazy referee when it comes down to it, and often the best ideas are the ones I steal from my players.
I consider that to be a master DM play myself. That's good.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you like it.
We have about 5 minutes remaining here, so I'm going to ask for final thoughts here. Dan, is a question burning the tip of your tongue here? that you want to get out?
Well, yeah. Okay. One other thing I wanted to ask James, of course. So prolific, and James puts out so much stuff, and he's got the Grognardia blog that he updates almost every day, sometimes multiple times a day, which is just a huge treasure for all of us in the old school community. He's got the excellent Traveling Volume, which is his EPT zine that comes out once in a while. You have a podcast now. That was actually news to me. So you've got the Hall of Blue Illumination podcast now. That's also EPT based, right?
Yes. It's a tech.
Fantastic. There's links to all this stuff in the description on YouTube. And my understanding is that you've been working for a while on a project called Secrets of Sha'arthen. And we have the draft cover there at the end. What is that going to be, briefly?
That is going to be, it's more or less my Tecamel. It's sort of I like Tecamel a great deal, obviously, and that campaign is continuing and I'm enjoying it greatly, but I've wanted to try my hand at my own sort of secret science fiction setting, and I have different interests and tastes that I don't fit in Tecamel that I'd like to try out, so that's more or less what this is. It's another fantasy setting that I'm much more slowly than I had hoped. I mean, I think I talked about it almost a year ago with you, and I'd hoped it was be closer to being something I could present to people. But it's coming along, and it's percolating in the background. But it's my take on that kind of genre, that sort of secret science fiction fantasy setting.
Great. You are in good company with people that take a long time to get their product out. So we couldn't sympathize more, right, Paul?
yeah, for sure.
But let me leave if you, James, have anything else that you want to talk about your long running campaign or projects, feel free to tell us. Maybe I've overlooked something that I should have asked about.
I think I'll say one other thing that I didn't mention, and that's that I think. You know, the two most important things that I have learned is that, you know, have a good group of people to play with that you can rely upon and that are committed to actually playing. And then beyond that, meet regularly, like do it constantly. Like we meet more or less weekly, keep it up. Every session is not going to be gold. You should not expect that every session is going to be filled with deep and meaningful and memorable things. But on the other hand, every single one of them adds a kind of depth and texture to the setting that you never know later on someone will remember, like, as I said, these details. And it'll make those sessions that weren't so interesting seem more significant over time. You're building something up, you know, bit by bit. It's just, you're just a little pebble here. And before you know it, you have this giant mound. And just keep at it. Really, don't give up too soon.
That's great advice. I love that.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Viewers, as Dan mentioned, links to all of these things, the podcast and Grognardia and various other works that James has worked on should be available in the description of the video here on YouTube. So please check that out. If you have any further questions about Tecamel or any of the myriad of topics that James has been on to talk about, whether it's secret sci-fi settings or D&D in general, please post them. Obviously, we love having James on. He's record-breaking 3 appearances on Wandering DMs. So leave us your comments and questions, and surely we will prepare ourselves for visit number 4.
Slowly leveling up, but James is at the head of our party. So if you're new to the show, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, the Wandering DMs. We are on YouTube and Twitch and Twitter and Facebook and GitHub and TikTok, and we do have the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites. So look for us there, follow, and you'll get updates on upcoming shows and upcoming guests like James.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available at our website at wanderingdms.com. They're also available through other third-party podcast carriers such as iTunes and Spotify and Google Podcasts and a large number of others, I'm sure. If you're listening to this show on one of those sites and it has the capability to do so, please rate and review our show there. That helps other users of that carrier find us, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, we really do. And big thanks to our patrons, of course, who support the show and are involved with the chat and add to our programs all the time. If you're in a place where you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. You'll see our different tiers. You can get discounts on our merch, access to a private Discord server, monthly behind-the-scenes stuff, and after-party chat that we hold every Sunday right after this show. So we'll be there in about 10 minutes to continue the conversation live with our patrons. And if you're not a patron, throw a dollar in and join our session on Sundays that we enjoy so much. You're going to be there today, Paul's right?
Yep, I certainly will. Looking forward to it.
Great. Awesome, awesome.
Please come and join us. I think it's a big benefit and definitely worth your while. A lot of interesting conversations, and some of our show topics come out of those chats. So please do join us.
That is correct. Other shows coming up this week. We have I play games from the Elder Times late night. This is going to be Tuesday at 11, and I'm still playing. I'm still hacking away at the Dungeon Hack game. I'm hoping I get through it this week. And then the week after that, we'll probably switch that show to Thursday nights, actually. But this week, still on Tuesday. Next week, we'll hope you'll be back because we've been planning to have one of the topics that came from one of our patrons, actually, is talk about Western, Wild West role-playing games, actually. And, of course, D&D was the first. And today, with James, we were talking about EPT, which was the second. And the third game right after that was Boot Hill, which was a Wild West game. And I know that James has played that. And in fact, the Wikipedia article on Boot Hill quotes James extensively for his review that he did of Boot Hill at one point. So we'll probably be referencing James again next week when we talk Wild West role-playing games, actually. So tune in then. But James, thank you so much for joining us. It's such a treasure whenever we get to spend time with you, and we really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I had a great time.
That's the best. So yeah, don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then. Bye, everyone.